You're listening to episode 1 of Fear the Boots interview series. In this show, we talk with RPG industry veteran Ryan Dancy. Running time for this episode is 1 hour and 8 minutes. Welcome to the first of the Fear the Boot interview series. This is a new series that we are kicking off mostly in response to some of the contacts we have gotten from the gaming industry throughout the course of doing the show. And rather than mixing the subject into our regular episodes, it seemed to make the most sense just to put this all together into a new series. So for the first interview, my name is Dan, and with me on the mics are Mike.
Hello.
Adam.
Hi.
John.
Hey.
And calling in via Skype, we have Ryan Dancy.
Hello.
And of course, you guys will remember that with Ryan, we did some commentary on his 2007 predictions for the RPG industry, which, much to our surprise, actually elicited a response on his blog, which is what led up to this interview. And actually, Ryan, that's kind of where I want to start. When we set out to make this show, we're pretty realistic about what it actually is, that it's out there on the internet for anyone to hear, but it's still just something we're doing sitting around a card table in the lower level of my house just for fun. And I guess when you put something out there like that, you really don't expect much of anyone to take notice. And as someone who is fairly well known within the industry, I'm just kind of curious on what your take is on art forms like podcasting or blogging or these sort of fan-based initiatives, and what has brought your attention to them.
I think that the one of the things a lot of people don't understand about the gaming industry is how small it really is, and the number of people that are engaged in working on gaming products or commentating on gaming products is a very, very small group of people. And when a new group shows up and gets involved in that mix and starts to, you know, make their opinions known and put their stuff out there for the public, it doesn't take that long for them to get noticed by the industry as a whole, because it's really so small. Certainly, I think that podcasting, blogging, people on internet posts have essentially become the de facto news channel for the gaming industry. It's so much faster than print, and the ability of a diversity of opinions to be expressed without a lot of editorial interference is very high. And as a result, I think most of the people in the industry who are paying attention to as many non-traditional news outlets as they can find. And I'm certainly one of those people. I'm always on the lookout for new, kind of fresh blood coming in to express their opinions and talk about how they see the industry and how they see the games they play. And that all feeds back into the mix when we get involved on a business level of trying to figure out what the next big thing is going to be or what people out there are really looking to buy and play.
You know, it's actually interesting you phrased it that way, because when we got into this, we got involved in a few discussion groups with various RPG podcasters. And one of the observations they had made that since has stuck with me is that, particularly in recent years, there has been a big decline in the fan magazines and the gaming magazines that once, back in the late 80s, mid 90s, was a very big thing. And they saw podcasting as sort of stepping up as that fan collective effort that takes the place those once held. In fact, that was actually my background. I got my start in role-playing games writing for one of the Facet fan magazines. And does that line up with how you see the role that podcasting plays?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think that there's a whole generation of designers and industry people that came of age during a time when things like alarums and excursions were key to the kind of the back channel communication about ideas and concepts and game worlds and all that stuff that has to kind of gel for a while before it can turn into a product. And it's mostly all gone. I mean, I think Alarms and Excursions is still being published, but if it is, it's totally a labor of love. I think people who might in the past have been found an entree into the print world are going directly into the internet world, and they're bypassing what's left of the print medium available because it's just not as good a solution for what they want to do as going digital.
Yeah, as you mentioned, there's a lot of editorial interference that we can just get right around, and there's really nothing in the way of Dragon Magazine that we're competing against that we have really no hope of smashing.
That is a bunch of freedoms we enjoy.
That's right.
You know, before we dig too much deeper into this, it's probably best for the folks at home that we give a little bit of a resume here on your Ryan. So I was wondering if you take just a couple of minutes to kind of plug yourself, explain who you are, where you've been, what you've done, just in case there's anyone like us out there that doesn't follow these things as well as we should.
Come on, don't be bashful.
Sure. Well, I have the unique and extremely privileged experience to say that I grew up to be able to do exactly what I wanted to do when I was 12 years old. When I was 12 years old, in a copy of Dynamite magazine that I found in my elementary school, there was an article about Dungeons and Dragons, and it was one or two paragraphs long, and it had a picture of a map with a bunch of metal figures on it, and no explanation of how the game was played or anything about what D&D was or the role-playing game as a concept. But for some reason, it connected with me and really fired my imagination, and I went and found those products and found out about that game and started to play, and I played D&D and Traveler and Gamma World and Twilight 2000 and 100 other games growing up, played them all through college, and after college I got married and I had a baby, and my friends and I, who were also getting married at the same time, were looking around for something we could do with our wives that didn't require a lot of money, and we could take small children to and not have to worry about them killing themselves, doing something when we weren't paying attention. And it turned out that role-playing games were one of those things. It was a perfect match for us. And we kind of got back into it and started to play quite often. We had a regular weekly game. We had about 8 or 9 people in it at one time, wives and husbands. At the time, we were my business partner, Steve Milton, and I were working for a company called Multiple Zones International. And they did the Mac Zone and the PC Zone, hardware and software sales. And so we had kind of gotten this insider look on how distribution worked and how you bought products from distributors and how much money you saved when you did it. And we said to ourselves, well, we're spending a lot of money on D&D, and it's a pretty expensive hobby, even though it's cheaper than a lot of other things we could be doing. And I think we can make it even more cheap. So what we're going to do is we're going to create a fake mail order company, and we're going to use the fake mail order company to get a distribution account, and we're going to buy all the products we need to get through distribution, and we'll get it at half off.
Anything that begins with a front company is bound to be brilliant.
Brilliant.
Yes, exactly. So we called up TSR to find out what the advertising rates were for Dragon and Dungeon Magazine. And the advertising rate in Dungeon Magazine was practically nothing. I don't remember exactly how much it was, but the number $400 sticks in my mind for a full-page ad.
Wow.
And I think it was like $200 more if we wanted to do it in color. It was, at the time for us, you know, it wasn't throwaway money, but we thought it was doable. And so we figured, well, okay, it's not going to be as cheap as we thought it was, but we know 20 or 30 other people are playing games, and so we'll just call them all up and tell them we're going to have this mail order company. We can get their stuff for them, too, and we'll basically sell to them at costs, right? I tell you right now, there are retailers, publishers, and distributors who are listening to this who are screaming at me because it is the nightmare of the entire industry that people do this. It's horrible. So kids listening at home, don't do this. Buy from your local retailer. So we ran this ad in Dungeon Magazine and took it to a distributor and said, we're a mail order company, we want to buy products from you. And they were willing to do that, and we entered into a relationship with them. We were buying products, and then the phone started to ring. And it turned out that the fake mail order company wasn't fake for about a week. There was a pretty big pent-up demand from people to buy role-playing products who didn't have a local retail store. And for whatever reason, we just kind of lucked into it, and it turned out to be a real business. And that company was called RPG International. And we ran RPGI for, I don't know, 2 or 3 years as a sideline to our other business, which has nothing to do with gaming. It's an ISP and data conversion company. I met John Zinser through that connection. John and I had a mutual relationship with a company making Campaign Cartographer, which is Pro Fantasy Software, which is still around. And John at the time was running Shadus Magazine. And Campaign Cartographer wanted to run ads in Shadus Magazine, and they were based in the UK, we were based in the United States, and they wanted us to kind of check out Shadus and find out what was going on with it. So I called him and talked to him about advertising, and we hit it off. We just ended up being two peas in a pod, and today John is one of my very best friends. This was in 1994. We all went to Gen Con to meet more people in the industry and kind of get a hold on what was going on and to explore avenues to do wider sales and distribution with RPGI, and that was kind of the year when the trading card game business just exploded. And every single booth that you went to was selling a collectible card game. And the sales numbers that we were hearing from people on the inside were astronomical. They were immense. And I looked at John, and John looked at me, and we both said, this is ridiculous. We could do this better than half these guys. So we did, and we started a company called Five Rings Publishing Group. We published Legend of the Five Rings. Legend of the Five Rings was concepted in 94, and designed all throughout the end of 94 and the mid part of 95. And in late 1995, that product was released. And we had the fantastic timing to release it right in the middle of the biggest industry meltdown in history, when every other collectible card game collapsed and died a horrible, ugly death.
I remember the Decipher Star Wars collapse. Those were hard times.
Oh,
let's not talk about it. It still makes me weep at night.
It was brutal. It was brutal. But it was a fantastic time to be introduced into the ins and outs of the industry, because we learned so much from so many people who are willing to share their knowledge of how the business worked and how the finances worked and how products got made and how products got distributed and how products got retailed. And we talked to customers all over the country because we were forced to basically go to every convention we could find to do demos of this game. It was an amazing experience, and I wouldn't trade it for the world. It was probably the only way to get a, you know, really fundamental grounding in how the business of making hobby games actually works, is to just get in there and do it. And boy, did we do it. We worked our asses off. There was a huge team of people that were involved in that grassroots effort, and I think every one of them was changed in some way by the experience. We all ended up with a really deep and profound understanding of just how many people there are who are playing hobby games as a significant portion of what they do with their spare time, and how many people identify themselves as hobby gamers. It's a part of who they are as people. And after we did Five Rings Publishing, we were essentially in the gaming industry. We were a full-time publisher. We were making games and selling games and getting games designed, and working with artists and all that other good stuff. And we ran out of money. And, and as with a lot of companies in gaming, it turned out that we couldn't make enough money doing what we were doing to keep the company alive, and we had to go do something else. And the guy that we had hired to come in and run Five Rings Publishing, a guy named Bob Abramowitz, had an ancient connection with Lorraine Williams, who was the owner of TSR. And he called her up and said, "We want to come out and talk to you about doing a deal." And she said, "Fine, come out and do that." And so we flew out to Lake Geneva and had a meeting with her. In the middle of that meeting, I turned to Bob, Bob turned to me, and we looked at each other and said, "This company is going to die. They're dead." They had financial problems of epic proportions. They were finished. There was no way they were going to survive. And whereas we thought we were going to make a pitch to her to buy our company, we ended up making a pitch to her to sell her company to us. And we were able to broker a deal for that to happen. And then we flew home, and of course we had no money. We didn't have access to capital. And it was a pretty big deal. The number was a pretty big number.
I know exactly where you're coming from, though. I'm actually in the process of buying Hasbro right now.
That's probably not a bad investment. Their stock price is up over the last 5 years. And so we called Peter Axson at Wizards of the Coast. And we asked Peter to loan us $1 million. And Peter said that there was nothing in the world we could tell him that would get him to loan us $1 million. And then Bob faxed over the front page of the letter of intent to buy TSR, and Peter called us back in 15 minutes and asked if we wanted a company check or wire transfer for the money.
You know, actually, when people say that, the phrase I found that usually works is, "I have your daughter in my trunk."
Yeah, well, in a very real way, we had Peter's daughter in our trunk because he loved D&D. And that was the beginning of everything. I mean, we brokered a deal for Wizards to buy TSR, and I spent weeks and weeks and weeks in Lake Geneva working on the transition. And then when that was done, part of the arrangement that we made with Wizards of the Coast is that they would buy Five Rings Publishing. And before you knew it, I was in an office in Renton at Wizards of the Coast working for Peter, right in the middle of ground zero of everything that was, you know, amazing about the gaming industry at that time. Amazing people and amazing products, and just, it was a fantastic experience. It was great.
So you actually brokered the deal that sold TSR to Wizards of the Coast?
I did, yes. Absolutely,
wow.
I did.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Yeah, and I sat out in Lake Geneva with Lorraine and broke the news to her that it was going to be Peter buying her company, and it was a shock to her to find out that was going to happen. She didn't have a very good relationship with Wizards of the Coast. She really saw Wizards as an upstart that had no reason for existence. And, you know, the idea that she was going to end up selling her company to Peter was a tough one for her to take, but she didn't have any options at that time, and so it just had to happen. And it got done. And it was a you know, one of those wire act deals, which I think a lot of financial deals are, where everybody's wondering if it's going to happen until the absolute last minute, and then it happens, and it all got done. And so I was at Wizards of the Coast. When I went to Wizards of the Coast, I went into a group called New Brand Development and Licensing, and my boss, the guy I reported to, was Rich Fukutaki, and Rich's mandate from the company was to find new businesses that Wizards could grow into because they thought it would be very difficult to make another Magic the Gathering. The New Brand Development and Licensing was responsible for the four or five little card games Wizards produced, like The Great Dalmoody and Guillotine and Alpha Blitz and Twitch and all those games. And it was the place where the Arc System games got designed and tested. And then all the Five Rings Publishing games were in that group, and all the games we had in development were in that group, which a lot of those games eventually got published, Dune and Legend of the Burning Sands, and we were able to take over for the Battletech brand team when they moved on from their project. And then in the fall of 1998, Peter came to my office one day and told me that he wanted me to come take over the Tabletop Role-Playing Group. And they were concerned that after the acquisition, D&D hadn't grown as much as they thought it would grow, and they thought they had structural problems with the way the business was being managed and the way the products were being developed, and they wanted to give me a shot at coming in and fixing that business. Yeah. And so I did.
I was actually trying to avoid derailing you. I've been writing down notes on things I want to come back to. But great. When you hit that point, there's actually something here that's relevant to the immediate story that I'd like you to develop, which is, could you talk just a little bit about why D&D, near the end of second edition, wasn't growing?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Well, there's a whole bunch of factors, I think, that all combined at the same time to cause D&D a lot of problems. The number one problem that D&D had was that the people who were responsible for making decisions about what D&D products to publish had no idea what their customers wanted to buy. They really didn't. TSR at that time was a very insular company, and it was run by people who had been running TSR for 20 plus years, and a bunch of those people had very strong opinions about what they thought made good D&D products. And they wanted to make those products even if they didn't have any reason to believe that people would buy them. And as time went on, they made more and more products every month trying to catch up to the revenue that they thought they needed to make in order to stay in business. So if the first thing that they tried to sell didn't sell as well as they thought it should, they made a second thing, and then a third thing, and then a fourth thing, and then a fifth thing. And by the time we came in and took over, you know, TSR, Wizards of the Coast bought TSR, I think that their annual release schedule was somewhere in excess of 100 products a year.
Wow.
Are you telling us that this is the phenomenon that was responsible for products like Red Steel?
Absolutely. Yep.
I see.
Absolutely.
I was ready to forgive the complete Psionics handbook, but after that, no more patience from me.
Yeah, you'll probably remember that there were about 10 campaign settings that were in active production schedules.
Oh, yeah.
Plus, they had those audio CD games for the basic D&D game that were kind of not described as basic D&D. And then they were working behind the scenes on all kind of other things. They had the alternative games in development. At one point, they actually developed a kind of gothic horror game that they were going to use to compete with Games Workshop that never got published, even though it was in their catalog. They just had a ton of stuff that was being produced. And the net effect of that was that they had a fixed number of people out there who were willing to buy D&D products every month. And those people were being asked to split the money they could spend on D&D across this massive amount of releases. And so none of them sold enough to make themselves profitable. And at the end of the day, all other factors being equal, that was the problem with D&D. They were selling too many different things across too many different product lines to too few people. And that was essentially an unfixable problem for them because their corporate culture wouldn't let them fix that problem. There was just no way for anybody at the top level of that company to come in and say, we have to stop this and try something different. It was impossible for them to do that.
So somebody really loved Spelljammer and couldn't see it not being knocked off of the campaign setting list to try to consolidate the market.
Correct.
Gotcha.
Absolutely right. Yeah.
Okay,
absolutely right.
So as at this point, this is where I know a little bit of the RPG history, where you started in with the, and I believe a lot of people involved too, with the Open Gaming License and 3.0 and 3.5 and...
Well, 3.0 was in development when we bought the company. TSR had a plan to do a third edition of Dungeons & Dragons.
Were they taking it a similar direction to what actually came out?
No, not at all.
this is the story we want to hear.
It was basically going to be 2.5. It was going to be the second edition rules with some upgrades and some changes, and mostly cosmetic updates to the core books. A lot of people were wondering if like things like skills and powers were going to become the new version of D&D, and there was never a plan to do that inside TSR. Not that I ever read about it, and none of the people that worked there that I know ever thought it was. The 3.0 documents that we got from them were pretty much a 2.0 tune-up. I think there may have been some mechanical changes that they were contemplating at the time, based on some of the research they did for the alternative line, but I think that if the third edition game that TSR had envisioned in making had gotten published, that people who were playing 2.0 would have had very little problem upgrading to it, virtually with no significant changes. And we scrapped that plan, obviously, because we knew that's not what the market wanted to see. And Peter has very strong opinions about what he wants out of D&D and wanted out of D&D. And And, you know, Peter is one of those people who listens to customers and cares a lot about what people think. And he has been playing D&D his entire life. And when he was given the opportunity to change the direction of Dungeons & Dragons, he took it. And he basically told the TSR designers that they had to start from a blank sheet of paper and that he was going to give them some very limited marching orders about things they could and could not change. And then it was their job to figure out how to make the best possible product that they could. And I frankly think they did a fantastic job. I mean, that design team is amazing. Jonathan Tweet, Skip Williams, and Monty Cook were the tip of that iceberg. There were probably 25 or 30 people working in the RPG R&D department who had their fingers all over 3rd edition and contributed a massive amount of stuff to it. It was really a group effort. And when I took over the business in 1998, they were on their second or third draft of the 3rd edition rules, and a lot of the things that are in 3rd edition today were in those drafts, things like the unified die mechanic, the three saving throws. I think the multi-classing rules were roughly there, although I think there was still a lot of work to be done on them. But a lot of the stuff that actually made it into print was in the drafts they were working on when I was asked to take over the business. So it's not at all fair to say that I was, you know, responsible for the fundamental changes that happened in 3rd edition. My responsibility was in kind of taking Peter's marching orders and making sure that the team stayed on tack. And then when we started to get good market research in, to make sure that we were making the game reflect what the customers actually wanted out of the game. Which wasn't that hard, because Skip and Monty and Jonathan are bright guys, and they're very data-driven, and we showed them market research data that they could believe. They listened and learned and made the changes that needed to be made.
How do you go about collecting market research data on the RPG market?
It was very difficult.
Do you like sorcerers, yes or no?
Barbarians, you know, discuss.
We did quite a bit of that, actually, as funny as it might sound. The reason that the magic missile spell, for example, does not have a saving throw, is even though it should, is that the feedback we got from people when we did market research was that if we gave a saving throw to magic missile, they would be very unhappy, and most of them would just play the game without a saving throw.
Hey, the bomb should cast shield. That's what shield's for.
Exactly. And the reason that the paladins could only be lawful good was that by far the feeling on the part of the market players was that paladins should be lawful good, that they should have a code of honor, and that they shouldn't be able to be anything but lawful good.
Well, thanks for taking out the tithe. I don't know who is responsible for that, but that was real kind of them.
Yeah, I think the monk got stuck on the low end of the totem pole for money in 3rd edition.
Yeah.
Only yeah, but we money, did. We conducted a professional market research study, and by professional, I mean we actually went out and hired a market research company and then worked with them to get the data collected correctly, statistically correctly. You can see the results of that survey on the web. If you search for Wizards of the Coast market research, you'll probably find links to it if you Google it. That data that we publicly disclosed is the most complete and most accurate market research data that the public has ever seen about the hobby gaming industry.
Yeah, actually, there's a thought right there I'd love to hear expounded on a little bit. You talk about getting the correct market data, and of course part of making these things statistically significant is making sure you have the right demographic represented. That if you're doing a poll of the U.S. and if X percentage of the U.S. is a certain race, you have to get that percentage of that race represented in your section. What does the overall demographic of gamers look like?
Well, when we did the market research, we limited the upper age range of the data we were collecting to people who were 35 and younger.
Really?
And we did that for a whole host of reasons, but the primary reason that we did it was that we had preliminary data that we gathered before we started the main survey that showed that as people grew older, they bought less and less products. And so we were mostly interested in getting market research data on people who were likely to buy the products, even though we knew that there was this huge population of people who were playing them who might not actually buy something.
That's so fascinating.
In that context, the data that we have doesn't necessarily represent, you know, hobby gamers, all of them. It represents hobby gamers who are likely to buy a product. So with that caveat, what we found was that most people who played tabletop role-playing games were 18 years old or older. We found that they were from middle to upper middle-class incomes. We found that they tended to live in suburban areas as opposed to urban or rural areas. About 20% of them were women. We found that they
20%?
Either had, yeah, 1 in 5.
Yeah. Wow, that's a that's huge for.
Yep.
Wow,
I didn't think there were that many gamer chicks.
Yeah, neither did I. See, that's funny because I thought there were more.
Really?
Yeah, must be a generational.
You know,
thing.
This is something, Brian, to give you a little context. We've kicked around on the show before. Is that sitting around the mics, we've got people that range. I'm at the high end at 30,
and I'm the low at 21.
Yeah, John's low at 21, but despite the fact that we're less than 10 years apart, there's a big generational gap between my experience as a gamer and John's, because I grew up in the last of the generations where people that played tabletop games or video games or anything like that were the nerds and the dorks and hated and outcast. But John comes from that generation where it all changed and gaming suddenly became mainstream and popular and acceptable.
And yeah, that's right.
So I think that's why there's probably some disparity here, because to someone like Mike or I on the older end, we could swear there's like 1 in 100 females that game.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas someone like John probably might
as well, 4 out of 10.
Yeah, might as well be a 60-40 split.
Yeah.
Well, I think you could describe that as pre-White Wolf and post-White Wolf.
Really? Think that's what made the change?
I know it is.
Really?
Yeah,
why?
I have no doubt in my mind. The World of Darkness games were revolutionary in that they appealed to a much broader demographic base than Dungeons & Dragons and most of the war games that became role-playing games that preceded them did. And after the World of Darkness games came out, you see a dramatic shift in the demography. There are lots more women playing those games, and the people who are playing them they're different in what they express as their interests. The pre-White Wolf people have an interest in history and in the military, sometimes in very esoteric, you know, off the beaten track stuff, things I would consider to be, you know, geek or nerd things, which I am a member of, so I'm not trying to disparage anybody. And the post-White Wolf demography, you see things like music, film, lots of different kinds of literature, and then you've got this increased, you know, gender ratio of women coming into the hobby, and they bring with them a whole bunch of hobbies and interests that the men will never have. So it was a clear and obvious demarcation when those White Wolf games happened.
That's awesome. I've always wondered what made that big change from it being in purely geekdom to it being mainstream. I never knew it was White Wolf.
You know, if you look at Vampire, for example, it's a game about dressing up in cool clothes, going out to bars, getting drunk, hitting on women, and getting lucky.
It makes sense.
Most of the world calls Friday Night, but White Wolf calls the World of Darkness.
That's fair enough.
Okay, so while you were at WotC, you did a lot with 3035. Checking your resume, I saw you were also involved in the D20 edition of Star Wars, I believe.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, I think was a huge improvement on the Yahtzee version by Westin.
Oh, God, boo. Worlds apart.
All right, so coming through to the end, what took you out of WotC, and where are you at today?
Well, my time at Wizards was some of the most exciting and interesting work that I've ever done. But the company was a very, very stressful place to work. And in the middle of our efforts with role-playing and dealing with Dungeons & Dragons and creating the Anthem Gaming License, the company published Pokemon. And my old boss down in New Brand Development Licensing, Rich Fukutaki, is the guy that actually signed that license and committed the company to doing that game. But he was actually let go before the game was wildly successful because the company didn't understand exactly what a gold mine he'd given them. In amongst the stress that we were dealing with as the company went through the changes of growth with Pokemon and the build-out of all the retail stores and then being acquired by Hasbro, senior management and I didn't have very much in common anymore about what we thought the goals and objectives should be for the business. And it was just time for me to move on. And at the time, as you can probably imagine, in Seattle, I'm talking about in 2000 and early 2001, which was the middle of the dot-com boom, it seemed like anybody with a reasonably good business plan for a high-tech business in this town could get it funded. And I thought I had a reasonably good idea for a business. One of the things that we discovered in all the market research we did inside Wizards of the Coast was the impact and importance of what we called organized play, little O, little P, organized play. The idea that people will be more likely to buy, play, and keep playing a game if there's some structure provided around the play experience, whether that is finding other people to play with, or scheduling a day on which the game is to be played, or reporting the results of that game, any number of things that can organize what people are doing with their games has a huge impact on their actual play activities. So I wrote a business plan for a company called Big O, Big P, Organized Play, and the idea was that we would create a service company, that we would sell services to people, to publishers in the gaming industry, and they would use that company to essentially replicate a lot of the systems that Wizards of the Coast had built internally through trial and error. And we got that business launched, and we signed a few customers up, and we developed a bunch of the software, and then September 11th happened. And as you can imagine, that was pretty much it for investments in high-tech gaming companies in Seattle. It really drove a stake in the heart of the finance plan. So after that happened, we kind of wound down organized play, and today it continues to exist, but it's a very small business, and it primarily exists to kind of service clients who have a short-term need for organized play while they're bootstrapping themselves into a more sophisticated program. And my friend Luke Peterschmidt and I, Luke is a guy that I hired to do design work for some Firebrands publishing games, and then we eventually hired him at Wizards of the Coast as a brand manager. He left the company shortly after I did to co-found Sabretooth Games, which held the Warhammer 40K trading card game rights. And then when that company was bought by Games Workshop, he left Sabretooth, and he and I started a consulting business, which is called The Core Market. And today, that's what we spend most of our time on. We do business consulting for the entertainment industry, people who are creating games and comics and films and a number of other businesses that are all related to entertainment. We write business plans and marketing plans, and we do some product development. In fact, Luke has been involved with Mattel in designing a couple of games that they've either released or have finished and are waiting to release. So we kind of still are involved in the gaming industry tangentially, and we get calls constantly from people who need our advice on topics related to hobby gaming. So even though we're not actively working for hobby gaming companies, we're still pretty deeply involved in the business of hobby games.
Stepping back for a moment to your Wizards of the Coast days, is there anything you can tell us about WotC's vision for the future of our favorite games? Or is that sort of privileged information?
I can tell you what I knew when I left the company, but I don't know how valuable that is today. It was, 7 years ago. When I was in charge of the Tabletop Role-Playing Group, we wrote a 5-year plan for role-playing for Wizards of the Coast. And a key cornerstone of that plan was to double the size of the business by increasing the size of the role-playing business in Europe. The European side of the role-playing business has always been the red-headed stepchild of American publishing companies. And in Europe, there is a very large and significant number of people who do play role-playing games on a very regular basis. And primarily in Europe, the games people play are dictated by what country they live in. So people who live in Germany, for example, play Das Furcht Auge, which is the Dark Eye. And it is essentially the Dungeons & Dragons of Germany. It's very popular. It's published by one of the largest publishing companies in Germany. And if you were German, you would know all about Das Furcht Auge, and you might not know that much about D&D. People in France play a lot of Call of Cthulhu, and there's a number of French language games they play. People in Sweden and Denmark and Norway play all kinds of games that all look like variations on Games Workshop's Warhammer 40,000 model, even though they're not Games Workshop games. And then in England, most people play Games Workshop games. They play miniatures games, either fantasy or Warhammer Fantasy or Warhammer 40K. So we believe that if we worked the problem and built a good distribution network in Europe and made products that were appropriate for the European market, that we could double the size of the role-playing business at Wizards of the Coast by selling those products in Europe effectively. As you probably know, none of that happened. for whatever reason, Hasbro and Wizards don't have a very effective European role-playing game strategy, and they certainly haven't doubled their business by doing that. The other thing we wanted to do is we wanted to grow the RPGA to 1 million members. We had very good data that suggested that there were 1.5 million people who played Dungeons & Dragons every month in the United States. And we knew that when 3rd edition came out, that number was likely to go up. And I have heard anecdotally that the internal data that Wizards has says that number maybe as high as 2 million people today. So we believe that a part of building a long-term solid foundation for D&D was to re-energize the RPGA and to get most people who played Dungeons & Dragons to become RPGA members and to participate in RPGA events. And the RPGA is much more successful than it was when we took over TSR, but to the best of my knowledge, it doesn't have anywhere close to 1 million members in it. That's unfortunate. I would like to see the RPGA be even more successful than it is. I think having an organized body of players to vocalize and represent player interests in the D&D community is crucial. And,
oh, yeah.
And the RPGA is the best venue to have that happen. Hmm. Magic the Gathering has a fantastic plan, which they are executing on. I'll tell you that inside Wizards of the Coast, we had a saying about the games that at the time were most meaningful to Wizards of the Coast. And it began with the Magic Group. And the Magic Group defined their game as, it's the game where you kick your friend's ass with really cool monsters. That was Magic.
Unless you play blue, then you just stop them.
Yeah, that's right. And then we evolved a saying for D&D, which is, it's the game where you and your friends kick the asses of the monsters. And then Pokemon was the game where the monsters who are your friends kick each other's asses. So essentially, any combination of friends, asses, and monsters was going to be successful inside Wizards of the Coast.
Oh, God. That's a really disquieting thought, thinking of where they could take that in the future.
And you clearly, know, you know, Pokemon is gone because it went back to the Pokemon Company. But the Magic strategy of being a game where you kick your friend's ass with really cool monsters is exactly the strategy they're following, and it works really well for them.
Thought there I'd like to chase, and I realized with Magic the Gathering, you don't really have a lot of directions to go with it because it's a competitive card game. But in looking at the advertising over the years for most even role-playing games, it seems as if it is all geared towards, I guess what you would really call the dungeon crawl. That it's about kill the monster, get the loot. And I have never really seen any good, strong run of ads that attempts to break that down by playing up a storyteller's aspect or kind of showing any depth to this. And there's a part of me that has to wonder if breaking that barrier is part of what stands in the way of helping role-playing games get to that next level within the market of saying, hey, this doesn't just have to be about people moving little men around a dungeon and killing things. You can actually have a more evocative experience out of this. And I'm curious why nobody has chased that.
Are you talking about for role-playing games?
Yes, for card games. For role-playing games. I realize, card games are, they're competitive games. I mean, that's what you do. It's like in poker. Nobody plays poker for the story. And sure. It's the same thing here. I mean, so I'm talking specifically like role-playing games. And
sure. Well, I mean, I think one of the things you have to remember is that role-playing games are really two businesses in one. You're selling a product to people who are going to play the game, and you're selling a product to people who are going to make things for the game, the storytellers, the dungeon masters, and the game masters. And those people are looking for very different things in the products that they buy. The people who are going to play the game, the players, are interested in an experience that is something like what they would like to imagine themselves doing if they were heroes, if they were guys in spacesuits, or guys in armor, or guys who are vampires, guys being used here synonymously for men and women.
Right.
And then the people who create the content, the game masters, are looking for tools that will help them express the vision that they have for a story or a world. A lot of people who are game masters are either struggling or not so struggling fiction writers. They love to write novels. And role-playing games give them an outlet for a lot of that creative tension that's in them, where they can tell a great story through the medium of a role-playing game. So you have these two very different and very diverse targets that you're selling the product to. But most role-playing games sell most of their products to players in terms of unit volume. So what you typically see are ads that are designed to attract players that are already in the market to buy a game that matches up with some fantasy environment that they would likely be interested in. So you have this kind of catch-22. People who play role-playing games like a certain kind of genre. And therefore, if you're going to advertise in the places where people who play role-playing games look for role-playing game advertisements, you want to be advertising something that matches the genres they're already interested in. And that's why you see the same kinds of ads get run in Dragon Magazine year after year after year after year after year. It's people like those genres. They play role-playing games. Therefore, we're going to make a game for that genre.
All right, so if I'm following you right, what you're basically saying is that these products are designed and marketed to appeal to the experiences that the players as opposed to the game master would like to convey. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think that's an accurate statement.
That being the case, I guess kind of the angle that I would spin that on is in all the gaming groups that I've had access to, and granted, this is purely argument by anecdote. I mean, I don't have access to the kind of market data that you guys do. It struck me that it is typically the game masters rather than the players that introduce the players to the new games and the new products, at which point the players go out and purchase them. And if that bears out to be true for some fairly large percentage of the market, then it strikes me that it would behoove game companies to start modifying the way they sell these games to appeal to who really is the gatekeeper of what these gaming groups spend their money on, which is typically the game master.
I think the data, in large part, doesn't bear that out for a couple of reasons. The first reason is that most gaming groups never change games. They play D&D, or they play whatever game they were playing when they started. So when you're talking about groups that change games or that try their games, you're talking about the smallest part of the market. Now, that is the part of the market that everybody's going to have to market to. That's where the advertising dollars have to go after the people who are willing to change games and try different things. But I think what you see when you analyze the play pattern is that you'll have a game master who will say, I want to try game X. And everybody will say, oh, no, I don't want to do that. And then he'll say, I want to try game Y. And everybody will say, oh, no, I want to do that. I want to try game Z. And somebody says, okay, let's do that. And so that game Z is the game that gets played. So, yeah, it's probably the game master who's the impetus or the spark to get them to try a new game. But the Game Master has probably got a bunch of games he'd like to play that no one will ever play with him. And he has to find a game that somebody in the player group is already interested in trying, or that will be interested in trying once the concept is explained to them.
Many of those things Dan has been griping about for years.
Most of the game groups I know do play a wide variety of games, but yeah, the dynamic of the Game Master is really more willing to try new things than the players are. In fact, we actually just had a similar debate to this before we turned on the mics. Let me back up now. I was taking notes while you were giving us your bio, and there's a few points there that I want to go back and unpack a little bit. The first one I want to ask is, I am a firm believer that anyone successful in this industry is themselves a gamer.
Oh, yeah.
And that is what drives us to do this, because despite the jokes John makes about lighting his Swisher sweets off of $100 bills, you know, we all know this isn't really about the money. So let me ask you, what kind of a gamer do you consider yourself? Because you posted on our forum sort of a gamer quiz that has these broad archetypes of the kinds of experiences people want out of a game.
Yeah.
What kind of a person do you see yourself?
Well, when it comes to role-playing games, I'm the man in the middle. I'm one of that 12% or 18% who describes themselves as a basic role player. I find all of the aspects of role playing to be very interesting. The storytelling component, the tactical combat ideas, the problem solving, and the world building. I'm interested in all of it. So games that don't include all four of those things are things I don't find very interesting. Role playing games I don't find them very interesting. I don't play a lot of miniatures games, and I don't play a lot of family card games, although I certainly do when the family plays, I play with them. But when my gaming, when I get to pick the games we're going to play, I like to play board games, I like to play role-playing games, I like to play card games.
What role-playing games do you tend to play?
Well, recently I would say that the game I've been playing, that I have played the most recently or most often is D&D. There was certainly a period of time in my life when I played every game under the sun. My bookshelves are groaning with role-playing games. Two New Year's Eves ago, I ran a game based on The Secret Life of Gingerbread Men, which is a game published by Wicked Dead Press, which was an interesting game to play because I had an audience comprised of a bunch of 10-year-old girls and a bunch of wives of guys who played games who had never played a role-playing game in their life before. So the whole bake-a-cookie aspect of it went over really well.
All right, I gotta ask, what is this game? The Secret Lives of Gingerbread Men? What is this?
It's brilliant. essentially, the idea is that
at a certain
time of the year, gingerbread men come alive, and they run around the house, and they have adventures. And your character sheet is your cookie. Depending on what you bake into your cookie, your character gets various abilities. If you put certain kinds of gumdrops on, they get certain abilities. If they have candy canes, they get certain abilities.
That's awesome. I'd play
licorice,
this.
They get certain abilities, yes. And the gimmick is that every gingerbread man or woman has a secret. And the secrets are what drive them in their drama, and that's what drives the story. Trying to either resolve their secret or learn the secrets of other gingerbread men or whatever the secret is, it drives them. And so we constructed a story about finding the meaning of Christmas, and the gingerbread men were all involved in that story, and it was great.
Wow.
So if you ever have a chance to pick up a game, you can play with 10-year-old girl, Secret Lives of Gingerbread Men.
Outside of Adam, I don't have any 10-year-old girls in my life. But that's
still... Well, we have an up-and-coming one, my sort of stepdaughter.
Yeah. Now, okay, going back also to when you're talking about your biography, you mentioned one of the things that happened to you when you were running your distribution company is you got a lot of gaming requests from people that just did not have a gaming shop of any kind in their area.
Yep.
And this is something that even until today I have seen borne out in my own life, because doing a podcast that obviously is available worldwide, we have had quite a few people contact us and say, you know, hey, right now I'm either separated from my gaming group or I'm in an area where there really is no gaming going on, and you guys helped me get that fixed. And I'm curious, what drives that sort of poor geographic penetration? And is this natural? Is this good? Is this just a factor of the way free market works? I mean, what do you think is behind that?
Well, when we were running RPG International, we started that business, I believe, in 1990 or 1991, and we basically ran it through, I think 1994 was kind of the last year when it was really an active part of what we were doing. So that time frame kind of predates the internet of being a really powerful force in hobby gaming. It was certainly there, and there were people who were using it for hobby gaming and to find games and gaming groups, but it was nothing like it's become today. So when we were running RPGI, we were getting people who were receiving Dragon Magazine who literally had no other way to buy gaming product. There was no way for them to buy it. And for those people, we were a godsend. We were a solution to a problem that they didn't really know they had. When they started to see all the kind of games that were available, they could just order through the mail. They loved it. Now today, of course, there's a million websites you can do that at, and it's very easy to find games online. So I don't believe there's a big population of people anymore saying, I can't find a way to buy these games. There certainly might be people saying, I can't find a way to buy these obscure German board games, but even that's probably a problem that could be solved. One of the things that we found in the market research data was that active gaming groups are often in suburbia. I can talk about why that is in a minute, but as a result of the fact that they're often in suburbia, what you find is people who live in rural areas don't have a high enough density of gamers to generate enough business to support a game store. And as a result, there's very few game groups and there's very few brick-and-mortar game stores in rural areas. And if you look at a map of the United States, what you find is that most of the United States is rural areas, which means there's a huge population of people for whom the natural business development of the role-playing game industry, the tabletop, you know, gaming industry, doesn't support. They're in places where there just aren't game store alternatives. And without game stores, it's very hard to find gaming groups.
Hey, Ryan, a question for you. What advice would you give a would-be game developer?
Wow.
This is kind of broad. Can we narrow this?
Well, as far as getting their product out and to the publisher.
So you're saying somebody's got a product in hand,
yes,
that they want to sell. You're trying to actually just get it published.
Yep.
Okay.
So the first question that Luke and I often ask prospective clients is, do you want to have your game published or do you want to be a game publisher? And in the past, most people who wanted to have a game published were forced to become game publishers because there was no good alternative for them to get their game to market. That's no longer true. Today, there are a number of companies who would be very interested in talking with people who have produced a really good game, who would publish that game under a royalty basis or a revenue sharing basis or any number of business configurations you can imagine, so that a person who today just wants to see their game published doesn't have to go into the business of becoming a game publisher. If you want to start a company to publish games, in my opinion, the most critical thing you can do is figure out how you can sell enough of those games to justify raising money from other people to invest in your company. I think the worst thing you can do is to start a company with your credit cards and a mortgage on your house, because in today's market, it's likely you're going to lose everything if you do that.
Let's talk about that for a second. And when we were talking about your predictions, I believe, one of the things we were kicking around is sort of the bleak and stagnant nature of the RPG market right now. And I can't remember if it was in that episode or another one, but Chad brought up an interview that had been done with Stan Lee regarding a similar sort of phenomenon that's going on or has been going on within comic books. And obviously the golden BB to this whole thing is finding a way to break that. And I'm curious on your thoughts on that. Why has the market stagnated, and what do you think it's going to take to get this market growing and healthy again?
I think I have two answers to that question. The first answer is that if you look at role-playing games as a complete hobby, that is, every game available to the customer at any given time, we are probably living in a golden age of role-playing. There are more role-playing games, different role-playing games, available right now than there have probably ever been in the past. And a lot of those games are very innovative and very interesting. The vast bulk of those games are not commercial products, or they are not products for which there exists a market that would allow them to be printed and sold through the traditional three-tier distribution system. So they're being sold as PDFs, or they're being sold as print-on-demand products, they're being sold as web downloads of one kind or another. But they're out there, and there's a massive number of them. The other half of that equation is the published, commercially distributed role-playing games, for which there is an increasingly small number, and sales of which appear to be headed in a pretty negative trend downward. And my answer to that, or my comment on that, is that, in my opinion, that form of role-playing is probably doomed. And the market for that form of role-playing is going to go away. And when I say that, people always say, oh, there'll always be people who play role-playing games. And I completely agree with that. What there will be is an aging population of people who love playing tabletop role-playing games and will play them until they die. And there are millions of those people. So it's a very large community. It will easily be able to self-sustain itself for a very long period of time. But what will happen is that there will be fewer and fewer people buying those games. And as the number of people buying those games declines, the companies that publish them, they'll die. They'll be rendered extinct. They won't be able to continue. And the biggest factor that's influencing the decision of people to not buy tabletop role-playing games is online role-playing games. It's massively multiplayer games. Massively multiplayer games are actively what I call predating. They are eating the tabletop role-playing game market by delivering an experience that most new players to role-playing games are looking for, and most people who play role-playing games find very, very engaging. That doesn't say anything about the game masters, who are being left in the dark by all the online guys, but the players of role-playing games are increasingly attracted to the online environment as the place where they choose to do their role-playing.
Well, what is so attractive about it? I mean, on demand? I mean, constant, exactly. Whenever you want content?
There's one difference between the two, and this kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier, which is the one thing that, as of right now, in fact, we did a pretty lengthy episode on this, and we're actually trying to get a hold of a guy who works within the video game industry to do another interview with us on this exact subject. But as it stands right now, video games, the one thing they can't really do is deliver a customized narrative experience. They can deliver a narrative experience, but not a customized one.
And that's right.
Because RPGs have so positioned themselves to really represent the hack and slash dungeon crawl, or at least that's the foot they're putting forward, this is simply put an experience that video games can do better, cleaner, faster, more attractively, more simply, more conveniently. And this kind of gets back to why I think it would behoove role-playing games to almost reshape themselves to offer something that at this point video games are completely and utterly incapable of doing. I have an older brother that he's a supervisor on the Xbox Live, I believe, support team. And he says that at Xbox, their philosophy is when they create the Xbox, they don't consider themselves competitors with Sony and Nintendo. They consider themselves competitors with television, movies, everything you could spend your disposable income or your free time on. This is what they are competing against. They're as much in competition with a rock concert as they are with the PlayStation 3. And it seems as if role-playing games just haven't quite gotten that mentality yet, that this is what they're in competition with, is these electronic experiences.
That's absolutely true. There's a lot of denial in the gaming industry right now.
Do they have a prayer, or what do you think they can do to combat it?
Well, I already know that some of the best designers in hobby gaming are going into designing online games. The lure of that market is so immense that it's like a magnet is pulling them in.
Well, it's a cash cow.
That's exactly right.
Yeah,
some of the very talented guys that I know have designed tabletop games their whole lives are going to work for online games because the pay is so good. There's just no way around that. I mean, that's just what's going to happen. Nobody in the tabletop gaming industry can afford the kind of salaries those online guys can pay, and so they're likely to attract the best talent over time, which causes them no end of problems. In my blog, in the entry that you guys actually referred to in your original show, the last prediction that I made in that blog is that I have this, what I call my spider sense tingling, that some kind of game platform is going to come from out of left field, and that its delivery mechanism or the way it gets sold may only overlap the existing industry as we know it partially, that a good portion of that business might exist someplace that we're not looking at yet. And I don't know what that game is, and I don't know what that game is going to look like, but there is something about the fact that there are things that the online games cannot do, combined with the fact that there is a 1,000-year-old tradition, probably 10,000-year-old tradition, of playing games on the tabletop with friends in a room, that leads me to believe that there is going to be some kind of game out there that will be successful. And trust me, if I knew what that was, I would be starting a company to publish that game right now. I have no idea. I'm just looking at what I call the need gap. There's a need and there's a gap. There's a need in what the players want and there's a gap in what's being delivered. And something is going to fill that gap. Nature abhors a vacuum.
Yeah, and
do I think the guys at the existing role-playing game companies can fix that problem? I don't think they can.
It almost seems that this rise of these smaller publishing companies, the PDF markets, that almost may enable this because of the simple fact that these people are willing to take the risks and to do the things that these large corporate boards won't do anymore. And so I can see exactly where you're coming from.
There's a lot of strength in their diversity. I mean, there's anytime you have that many bright people doing something just because they love it, there's always the chance that they'll just cook up something that's amazingly cool, which is exactly what happened with Magic the Gathering, which was a product that nobody could have possibly predicted until it happened. And then after it happened, everyone looked at it and said, well, that was obvious.
In my mind, what's really lacking in the video games that the old tabletop games provide is immersion and customization. And I don't know how the technology can provide that right now.
Well, there's also a social aspect, because when you play a video game, even if it's like a massively multiplayer online game and you're playing it with thousands or tens of thousands of other people at once, you still have this kind of wall of separation that I at least personally as a gamer, I can say I only get around the table. And that's for me why if something was to come along and say, okay, I'm going to wave a magic wand, and once it's waved, either video games or tabletop gaming will be gone. Which would you lose? I would give up the video games. As much as I love them, I'm an avid collector of video games, but I would sooner give those up because there is just something about that experience a role-playing game gives that a video game cannot. And I think if there was just some way to really help the people out there that have never picked these kinds of games up to understand the unique things this sort of hobby offers and work hard to differentiate it from electronic entertainment, that there is still some hope there of not necessarily salvaging the old industry, but giving the industry a second life in a new direction.
Well, it's interesting to me that online collectible games have never come anywhere close to affecting tabletop collectible games. There's just no comparison between Magic and Yu-Gi-Oh! And Pokemon and the 100 people who tried to do it online. It didn't work. And there's a similar correlation you can make between miniatures games or war games in video games and tabletop miniatures games. Now, the online war game business is huge. I mean, real-time strategy games are a giant category. But even though those games are successful, the success of those games doesn't seem to have affected people who want to play a miniatures game on the tabletop with miniatures they can hold in their hands. That business is growing, not shrinking. So what is it about the online role-playing experience which is hurting the tabletop role-playing experience? And my answer to that question I have two answers. My first answer is that for most players, the online experience is good enough. It's not perfect, and there's lots of room for improvement, but it is good enough to induce them to play the game online. And my second answer is that computer technology, unlike tabletop technology, is subject to Moore's Law. And every 18 months, it gets twice as good or costs half as much. And that is a ruthless force which is making those games get better and better and better. And every objection that people might choose to raise to say that online role-playing will never be like tabletop role-playing, the march of Moore's Law means that at some point in the future, and the probably not too distant future, that feature could be done with online technology and in digital gaming. Will it 100% replace the tabletop experience? For people who grew up playing tabletop role-playing games, it will never replace a tabletop gaming experience. For people who aren't growing up playing tabletop role-playing games as their first role-playing game experience, they will never notice the difference.
One of the big things, I think, is in the MMORPGs, you don't have to imagine the setting. You can see it for yourself, and it's sort of a lazy imagination sort of a deal.
Yeah, I think that's true. But you have to ask yourself, for most people who play role-playing games, was imagination ever one of the things that drew them to the format in the first place? And I think the answer is no. I think that for game masters, it absolutely is. And for a certain segment of the role-playing population, it is. But I think for most of the people who play role-playing games, imagination is not a feature. It's not a drawback, but it's just an aspect of the game.
Yeah, a gentleman on our forums by the name of Tim White brought an article to our attention by Wizards of the Coast about something they're just now kicking off called Expand Your Role. Are you familiar with this?
No.
Okay. Wizards of the Coast right now is starting an effort where they have set aside $20,000 in grant money to any, specifically a college-sponsored gaming club, and is only college-sponsored gaming clubs, where if you can convince them that you play D&D a certain number of times a month with a certain number of people, and you're sponsored by some staff member of this university, they will give you a grant of anywhere from $50 to $1,000 to go out and set up a website, to put up flyers, to even just buy snack food for the get-together that you're having.
That's cool.
And we spent a good portion of one or two episodes ago kind of kicking this thing around and looking at the ups and downs of it. And I was just curious, I guess you haven't reviewed it, you probably can't give me a deep answer, but just on the surface, what's your take on that?
Well, it's a good place for them to start. Wizards of the Coast know some things about college students that aren't necessarily self-evident. Let me refer back to a comment I made a little while ago about how I could talk about why there tend to be clusters of people who play in suburban air environments as opposed to urban or rural environments. One of the things that we discovered at Wizards of the Coast is that there are factors in people's lives which affect how likely they are to play a role-playing game and how much time they'll spend playing a role-playing game. And there's essentially two factors that are strongly involved in that equation. The first factor is their mobility. How mobile are these people? And the second factor is, how much discretionary income do they have to spend on entertainment? And what we found is that when both of those factors are low, the incidence of role-playing games in the population goes up. So you typically see that happen for kids before they get their driver's licenses, which means they're limited to pretty much how far they can get on a bike or where a parent can take them. And those kids usually don't have a lot of disposable income. Most of the disposable income they have comes from presents, gift money, or washing the car, mowing the lawn, that kind of thing. That's obvious. And you see a huge cluster of people who start playing role-playing games between the ages of 12 and 16. Then they get their driver's licenses, and they become much more mobile, and the range of entertainment options they have expands drastically, and their incidence of play for role-playing games declines significantly, right? Well, it turns out that happens again to a certain portion of the population, and that is when they go to college. They leave their cars at home, their mobility declines vastly over what it used to be, and a lot of their disposable income goes away. They're either spending money on things they never had to spend money on before, like food and books and lodging, and even though they may have worked while they were in college or in high school, they probably don't have a full-time job when they're in college, and their ability to earn is limited by the amount of time they spend in school. And we see rates of role-playing games in colleges skyrocket. In fact, there are more people who learn how to play a role-playing game for the first time in college than learn how to play a role-playing game between the ages of 12 and 16. So if you told me that Wizards of the Coast was going to spend money to encourage college playgroups to start playing D&D and to reach out to the people in that area to play D&D, I would say that is a fantastic strategy. That it completely conforms with everything they know about why people play role-playing games.
Now that you mention it, that's exactly accurate for my case anyway. I lost the car for a year or two there and played role-playing games. Not that I wouldn't have.
And if you look at where a lot of colleges are, they're not in urban environments. They're usually in suburban environments. And sometimes they're the only thing in the town. I went to school at Washington State University, which has a resident population of about 10 or 15,000 people and a college population of like 100,000. It is the town.
Wow. So you mentioned earlier that there's specific reasons why role-playing is not common in urban areas. And I'm curious what those are.
Well, first thing is that in a densely urban area, you have lots of entertainment activities you can get to without having access to a car. It's very easy to get to museums, concert halls, libraries, theaters, parks, all kind of recreational activities provided by social groups, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, YMCA, all that stuff. So your range of entertainment choices is vast, even for somebody who doesn't have access to a car. If all they're doing is taking the bus or subway or some other form of mass transportation, they can get to a lot of different things to do. And the second reason is primarily that we find that in very dense urban environments, there are a lot of social pressures against being a role-playing game player. And that may be a legacy of the time when D&D was kind of travailed in the media, or it may just be a natural aspect of the fact that people who live in dense environments are a little bit nervous, a little bit wary about people who don't leave their houses. If you have a lot of people in your neighborhood that are your peer group and you don't show up on the street to play stickball, people start wondering what's wrong with you.
Yeah, I would like to offer a perspective as either an urban or rural denizen, but I'm not. I fall right into the crosshairs. I am a suburban gamer who picked it up at age 12. So you got me. Good job.
Exactly. Me too. Guilty as charged. I did the exact same thing. Yeah.
There's a lot here I'm chewing on. When we kicked around the Wizards of the Coast, their D&D thing, we had some very specific objections to it because there's a lot in the fine detail that really struck us that what they were trying was basically a good idea, and that we were really pleased that they were making this effort to reach out and to expand the market. But there's just a lot of things in the fine detail that kind of the more we saw it, we could tell that a lot of this had been churned out by corporate decision rather than necessarily by a quick and nimble group that's directly in touch with the gaming market. And I don't know, obviously, how that much that's accurate. I mean, I don't lurk about the Wizards of the Coast boardrooms and hear how they make decisions. We also thought it was a little odd that in the way they set this up, they've specifically limited it to Dungeons and Dragons. And I understand they're going to put their money where their products are, but they didn't even say this has to be a Wizards of the Coast product, that it specifically had to be Dungeons and Dragons. And
that, well, that is an artifact of the corporation. That's because that money's coming out of the Dungeons and Dragons marketing budget.
Ah. That's fair enough. That's how we pegged it. So.
I'm seeing the light.
I don't even know that to be true, but I know that to be true.
Well,
I understand.
I'll fully admit I've never worked in the RPG market, but I've got a long time of corporate experience, so I know how the corporate game is played, even if I don't know specifically how it plays out within the RPG market.
While we have the authority on the line, I have a question for you about how the game was developed. One thing we've always wondered when we've been playing D&D, the economy seems kind of messed up.
I'll take it by that laugh that this is not an uncommon question.
Well, there is no economy in D&D, right? It doesn't make any sense. Look, in our world, there's this commodity that lies under the ground, and massive corporations have been formed to extract it, and one of them just made $39 billion in profit. It's called oil. if in the real world there was massive amounts of loot laying around underground, there would be huge corporations created to get it out, right? Dragons wouldn't be slayed by knights, they'd be slayed by armies.
Touché.
It would be the only thing that makes sense. But all that said, there's a simulation of an economy in D&D, which is reasonably well detailed and documented in the D&D design documents used inside R&D. And that's where things like the price for magic items comes from, and how much money a laborer gets paid for a day's worth of work comes from. It wouldn't at all work in the real world, it just couldn't function. But for the purposes of kind of game balance and making certain things work inside D&D, it probably works okay. At the higher end, it starts to become completely nonsensical, where guys are walking around with the wealth of nations in their, you know, on their backs and on their fingers and worn as jewelry on their necks. It becomes a little ridiculous.
Well,
hopefully by that point, no one's really caring about the economy anymore. Anyway,
even if you look at the cost of a horse and you look at what a laborer generally makes according to the player's handbook, they don't line up. I mean, you'd be working several lifetimes to afford a horse or a mule.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you. Well, you'll notice there's no animal husbandry in D&D either. Apparently you can't breed horses or mules.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, it's like I say, the economy, I'll call it the money system in D&D, exists to balance player power, not to simulate a real-world economy. And if you try and use it to simulate a real-world economy, it will drive you absolutely nuts. It will drive you crazy.
Well, Ryan, while we got you on the line, I could actually keep going with this for a while, but we've gotten unanimous feedback from our listeners that they like a one-hour show. So
sure.
I should probably bring this into home plate. But before we go, I'm going to give you the last word on all this. If there's anything on your mind related to this conversation or unrelated, you have the ear of somewhere between 1,000 and 1,500 people. What is it you'd have to say?
I'd like to say that no matter what people thought when they read my list of predictions, fundamentally I'm optimistic about tabletop hobby gaming, and I think that people are going to enjoy doing it and will keep doing it as long as they live, and that there will always be new and interesting things for them to do. And no matter what happens to the industry that makes those games, the people who enjoy playing those games are going to find a way to enjoy their hobby.
Thank you so much for joining us. This has been awesome.
Yeah, thank you, Ryan.
Yes, it has.
Thanks for having me.
We really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us, and we hope that you, the listeners, will stick with us, as this is the first in a long line of episodes we've got set up, and we've got people from the RPG industry, and we've also got some fairly high up people from the video game industry and a couple other places that have already offered to talk to us. So thank you guys very much, and we will catch you next time.
Thanks, Ryan.
This interview has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2007, fully owned by its host. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor, as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com.